Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Steve Chaney, the CEO of the American Security Project, and welcome to ASP. For those not familiar with us, we're a 501c3 nonprofit started some 10 years ago by some folks named Kerry, Hagel, Hart, and Rudman, and it was to discuss national security issues from a nonpartisan perspective, and as a consequence, they put together a small nonprofit that focused on the national security side with a significant number of 3- and 4-star retired generals and admirals on the board, along with a number of business folks who can keep us going, and then equal number of Republicans and Democrats. And we've had a number of issues over the years that we've discussed, not the least of which climate change, nuclear energy, nuclear security, energy security, terrorism, asymmetric operations, which kind of lends to the topic of today. And that is what comes after strategy for stabilization and reconstruction in Syria. And honey, I want to say it's about a year ago that we had some folks approach us that were very much interested about long-term, what are we going to do about reconstruction and stabilization in Syria? And I know some would think it's a little premature to be talking about it now. And perhaps it is. We all know the complexities that are involved there, the dynamics, the problems. I did have somebody come to me a couple weeks ago and said, we're going to start this stabilization process in September, October. I think he is an incredible optimist. If anything, it's years away, potentially. But that said, the time to start planning is now. We would hope we've learned some lessons between Afghanistan and Iraq and the rest of the Arab Spring. And of course, with a new change coming of administrations in January, we hope here at ASP that we can contribute to that dialogue and get this going. Now, part of the focus that we intended to have was talking about women and children, and we will talk about that a little here. As a consequence, we went out and got one of our adjunct fellows named Matt Freer, and he's publishing a paper today, Syrian Stabilization and Reconstruction, that will be up on our website. And what I'm going to have is Matthew Wallen will summarize that a little bit for you. Matthew's our fellow for public diplomacy here at the American Security Project. He's also been at work at the State Department, worked in the Office of Press Relations, and at the University of Southern California Center for Public Diplomacy. I'll follow Matthew with Hani Masri. Hani's an ASP board member, I'm proud to say. He's the founder of TYO, Tomorrow's Youth Organization, which is a nonprofit dedicated to enabling children, youth, and parents in marginalized areas of the Middle East to realize their potential as healthy, active, and responsible members of their community and family. Then we've very privileged to have Dr. David Pollack with us. He's the Kaufman Fellow and Director of Project FICRA, a program of research, publication, and network building designed to generate policy ideas for promoting positive change and countering the spread of extremism in the Middle East. And of course, he's at the Washington Institute. And last but not least is Betty Bernstein-Zabza, and she's the Senior Advisor and Director of Operations for Global Women's Issues in the Office of the Secretary of State. I'm trying to adhere to a pretty exact time frame. We got started a little early, which is a positive thing, because I want to give everybody the opportunity to talk. I hope you all talk maybe 5 to 7 minutes given. Then we'll have a little bit of a dialogue here, and then I'll open up to Q&A, and I'll talk about the Q&A when we get to that point. Everything's on the record. We're recording it. We will put up on our website probably tomorrow or the next day. We're also tweeting, I believe, and I think we've got it over there. So you can quote anybody that you want. With that, let me turn it over to Matthew to talk a little bit about our paper.
Thank you, General Chaney. And as the general mentioned, Matt Freer is the actual author of the paper. I worked with him a bit on it, and unfortunately he cannot be here today. But I will summarize some of the main findings in the paper and assess the situation we have in Syria today and what we'd like it to look like down the road. I think we could all agree that the United States is really good at military operations. We demonstrated that in Iraq and Afghanistan. We are excellent at invading and occupying a country when that is necessary. We are unmatched in the world today militarily. Unfortunately, we have a really bad habit of getting the end game completely wrong, whether that's from lack of preparation or from having the wrong preparations. So as you look at Syria today, without much U.S. intervention compared to past exercises that we've seen, Syria is an absolute mess. To put it in perspective, it's probably the most complicated conflict we have seen since the end of World War II. There are more non-state actors, state actors involved in this conflict than we have seen in recent history. Between just six cities in Syria, Hama, Homs, Dara, Latakia, Idlib, and Aleppo, there's been at least $6 to $7 billion in damage. Now, that might not sound like a lot in terms of U.S. dollars, but when compared to the actual infrastructure that's in Syria, that is massive. The UNHCR estimates there are 4.8 million refugees from this conflict alone. That is an absurd number, and as we've seen in the past week or so, we are now at the greatest number of refugees worldwide than we have seen in history, including World War II. The death toll in Syria, the last number that I saw estimated in February was about 470,000. I'm guessing it's probably somewhere around 500,000 by now. So it is an absolute mess. Keeping that in mind, we have to look past the mess and start preparing for what comes after. We don't know what's going to come after yet, but not having a plan and possibly alternative plans for addressing the situation afterwards would be a grave mistake. So let's look at a few of those lessons from past conflicts, including Iraq and Afghanistan and Somalia, and see where we can go from here. The first thing we're going to need is a quality stabilization plan. Now, this could involve quite a few things. One instance, we can look at it as less might actually be more. The numbers of troops you put on the ground and the number of partners you have in your coalition does not necessarily equate strength or power in an alliance or on the ground. We have to work locally with Syrians. We have to work with the people in the cities. We can't look at it necessarily from a national level first. We have to look at it from a ground-up, almost grassroots stabilization effort. Local security first, local stabilization, local reconstruction, and then you can add that into a national outlook. Quality is crucial. We have to be more careful about how we use reconstruction funds. In Afghanistan, they've been incredibly destabilizing in terms of causing corruption. And there's been a lot of wasted money as well. There are dams in Afghanistan that we've spent $300 million on. There's been a lot of infrastructure built that the local population doesn't have the technical expertise, skills, or funding to actually maintain after those projects have been completed. We have to look at the role of counterterrorism in this. Now, obviously, we have terrorist groups that are operating in the region, but we have to analyze whether or not counterterrorism and stabilization can work side by side. Sometimes they can, and sometimes they can't. Counterterrorism operations can be inherently destabilizing. If you have troops on the ground that are moving through cities, doing night raids and that sort of thing, that's not a sign of a stable environment. We also have to identify the strengths of our partners, whether those be partners on the ground or internationally. You can look at it almost in an economic sense. You have to have the people who are best at what they do from those various partners work specifically on those issues. We also have to look at this from a matter of inclusiveness. When it comes to stabilizing Syria, we have to see who's involved. We have to consider that ahead of time. One way to look at it is the more parties that we have involved in the stabilization process, the greater our likelihood of success. And that's for several reasons. These people aren't necessarily going anywhere. It's absurd to say that we can kill every terrorist or every insurgent on the ground. There's going to be people within the Assad regime, possibly within insurgent groups, that we might have to work with on the ground in order to come to an agreement on how to stabilize individual cities, areas, or regions. So that means we might have to make those unpalatable immediate choices in terms of how to stabilize the country. These people have a stake, and whatever that stake is, we have to incorporate that into a plan for Syria after the primary conflict ends. And we also have to build a relationship between the state and the individual. This conflict started because the state and the individual and groups had a bad relationship, essentially. And we see that from the policies of the Assad regime in terms of impoverishing the country. We have to rebuild that relationship, and it starts from the ground up and then towards the national. So we have to look at it also from a matter of localism. How do we get these people in these individual cities or areas or regions to work towards this? In this case, less may be more. You don't necessarily have to dump reconstruction funds into these areas because that can cause issues like corruption, as I had mentioned before, in Afghanistan. You have to work locally with the partners. That means being on the ground, working with people who live in the regions, not necessarily people from outside the country. Now, we obviously have the problem where we've got a lot of displaced people. We have to figure out who they are. What role do they have in a future Syria? We have to build a new vision for the country. And by we, I don't actually mean we. I mean the Syrians themselves. And we can help guide them on this process, but it's important to understand that this must be a Syrian vision. We cannot instill it from the outside. We have no idea, as I mentioned, what constitutes being a Syrian anymore. We wonder about the role of women, the essentially lost generation of children that we have in the country. With so many insurgents in the country, outside fighters, changes of territory, the role of the Kurds, what happens with the regime members, who are the Syrians? We have to consider this, what their roles are, what they have at stake, and what they all individually see as what's needed for a future Syria. And we have to work to integrate that into a positive vision that will help set a country, set a future for the country. We have to make that vision vocal. So once we get this process underway, we actually have to openly talk about it in public. We can't have all these meetings be behind closed doors. It has to be out there in the public so that nobody's in doubt of what's being talked about and everybody's aware of the stakes and what everybody's positions are. Now, certainly when you get into negotiations and stuff, there can be reason for secrecy. That's how any negotiation works. But if we're talking about making this an actual vision, this is what we want Syria to look like, it's got to be vocal and it's got to be in public. And it has to have value for Syrians. You know, we can't waltz into a country and dump reconstruction funds into it, use American and foreign companies to rebuild it. There is a role for a private industry, but you have to put Syrians to work. You have to rebuild Syria with Syrian hands. That means physically and from the standpoint of having a vision for the country. That creates value and decreases the chance that people are likely to destroy what they have physically worked so hard to build. Lastly, from the international perspective, we have to have real objectives for Syria, and they have to be positive objectives. We have to align them with our allies, and we have to align them with, in some cases, countries we might view as adversaries, whether that means Russia or Iran. Both have big stakes in the country, and we can't ignore that. They're going to have to be part of this process. That might be difficult. We've seen how testy it is to operate with these countries from a stabilization standpoint. But they're on the ground, and they're funding and fueling part of the conflict. We have to include them in the process. We all have to agree what the problem is. What do we actually want to accomplish in Syria? What is causing this? How do we address it? And if we're not all on the same page on that, it doesn't matter how many coalition partners you have, whether we have 66 or 5. We need quality partners who are working on this together, who have stakes and influence in the country. And we have to be realistic. We have to be patient. We can't magically transform Syria. The country has essentially been destroyed in many regions. It's going to take a lot of rebuilding. Europe, after World War II, was not rebuilt in a day. It was not rebuilt in a decade. There are still buildings that are being reconstructed in Europe within the past 10 years. Some of these buildings have been used as a symbol of peace between countries that were once at war. But you know, if you go into East Berlin a few years ago, there are still definitely signs of what happened. We have to incorporate this. We have to have a plan. We have to unify our partners on this. And it's got to be more than defeating ISIL or defeating Assad, because that's not a positive vision. That's a negative vision. We have to decide what do we want after, and without that vision, it'll be impossible to proceed.
See, that's a great summary. Thank you very much. Hani.
Person who came from that region, I grew up in Palestine, and I have, in my 74 years of life, I have never seen a situation in the Middle East as bad as it is on all levels, never, with all the crises that we faced and so forth. The turning point, we used to have democracies before, even in Jordan, in Syria, we used to have much more acceptance of all of the different groups that live in the Levant area. And it is, the Levant is basically totally different from the Gulf, where it is a Sunni Muslim people unified. The Levant is a people of different cultures. There's Shias, there's Alawites, there's Kurds, there's all these groups. And so we're facing a very, very difficult situation first to deal with the political situation before we deal with the construction in terms of what is damaged. It is a very sad thing what is happening now. Part of it, of course, I think Betty is going to talk about the Iraq situation, but part of it is our invasion of Iraq and our withdrawal, quick withdrawal from Iraq, and the whole thing went down the drain, as they say, from Syria, Iraq, and then Egypt, Libya, and so forth. The Syrian people are, to me, were one of the smartest, most intelligent people in the region, in trade, and it is sad to see where they are today. When this started, I made a bet with somebody, like Obama said, 6 months, that Assad has to go, and I made a bet within 6 months Assad will go. We failed. The president did not fulfill. I said, if the president of the U.S. said that, we will have Assad gone. Unfortunately, things didn't go that way, and it turned to be a very, very bad situation. And so we need much more action on part of the U.S. To stabilize the situation. And I agree, it's not about taking now part in terms of Assad versus ISIS, ISIS. It is all about stabilizing the situation that nobody wins it, and we start creating a certain coalitions and maybe, you know, start looking about the political process, how we are going to conceive Syria to be in after the situation is stabilized. And then we could look at the construction. There could be no construction while the conflict is as it is now. And there should be never a winner, full winner, because we have to take in consideration all the groups. At the beginning, yes, we wanted Assad to go, but today it is too complicated. We don't know who will come to power, whether it is ISIS or whether it is whatever. We have to maintain a certain form of a stable system of coalitions among the different groups. And maybe a Syria with central government and decentralize the regions into terms of governors who are elected by the regions, who can take more responsibility in terms of running the region they are in, but a central government that evolves all the group in it. And as Matthew said, the army has to be kept intact because it's a professional army. And because there is, everybody is like carrying guns, and it's a madness what is happening. Reconstruction part, this is that applies to Syria, that applies everywhere. If we do not take care of young kids from their early childhood and women in terms of empowering them, the region, we will not have a good population in 20 years. We have to work for the next 20, 30 years in creating a new generation. The new generation that exists in that area is a lost generation. So we have to look into planning for the future, for the next generations, in my opinion. And it's hard to say what will happen, but we should look at stabilization before construction, and then we look at how we will review the whole Middle East as a whole.
Arnie, great comments. Thank you. Dr. Pollack.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate the opportunity to be with you today. And the subject, of course, is a tragic one. And I must say my own personal experience with it has been very intense and often painful. The first time I went out in the field to try to deal as an independent researcher for a think tank with the Syrian crisis was in the summer of 2012. I was asked to be the translator for a European delegation to the Syrian refugee camps in Antakya, just across the border in Turkey. And I found, and forgive me for starting with this personal anecdote, but I think it's important to get it out on the table. I found that there were times while I was translating, and this had never happened to me in my 30-year career until that moment, when I had to stop. I just had to stop because I was on the verge of breaking down and crying. It was so hard to convey the awful stories that these refugees had to tell. And that was 4 years ago. and it's only gotten worse since then. And I think it's important to emphasize that the so-called ceasefire or cessation of hostilities is not stopping the bloodshed and the destruction and the flows of refugees and internally displaced people in Syria. So this goes on every single day. And for that reason, I believe that we cannot wait for the end of the war or for a political settlement in order to begin a much more urgent and effective humanitarian relief and reconstruction program. The Syrian government and its allies are not allowing humanitarian relief to reach most of the areas that they committed to in the cessation of hostilities and according to the UN resolutions. And therefore, I think it's time to start a program of humanitarian relief for areas of Syria that are accessible, even without permission from the Syrian government and its allies. And it's time to start today a program of reconstruction in areas of Syria that are safe. And there are areas like that that are safe even now from attacks by the Syrian regime and its allies or by the jihadis and their allies. So some of those areas are, first of all, Idlib in the north, secondly, Dara in the south, and third, the Kurdish regions of Syria in much of the northern border. And in all of those areas, there are local councils. There are NGOs that are active even now during the war. There are civilian populations that need protection and deserve protection and aid and reconstruction even before, as I say, the war is over or a political settlement is reached. So I would advocate strongly an urgent program, piece by piece, not necessarily for the whole country or for every group in the country, not necessarily with permission from the Syrian regime, and not necessarily by government agencies or government security forces of any kind. NGOs are actually capable of doing a lot of this work in those areas, at least, that are relatively safe even now. And there are many, many NGOs to choose from, American, international, and local. I want to talk, because I was asked to say a few brief words about the Kurdish population and areas of the country in particular, which is something that I've specialized in the last few years. The Kurds are only about 10% of the total pre-war population of the country, something probably just under 3 million altogether. So this is not going to solve the problem, obviously. But these are people who have carved out for themselves a de facto autonomous region all along most of the Syrian-Turkish border, in which they are governing themselves and protecting themselves against both ISIS and Assad. And we, that is, we the United States, the U.S. government, the U.S. military, has made a very controversial but I think correct decision to work very closely with the leading Kurdish political party and militia in Syria, the PYD and the YPG, despite the objections of both the Syrian government, the Russians, to some extent, the Iranians, the Syrian opposition, the Arab opposition that we're also working with, and of course, most of all, the Turks. We have taken this position and we've stuck with it. But the problem is that as we provide what I think is, as I said, rightly, the security assistance and the diplomatic cover that these Syrian Kurds need to protect themselves, we are not providing reconstruction in that part of the country. And we could be. We should be. Kobani, a city that was utterly destroyed in fighting between the Syrian Kurds and ISIS, and many other cities and towns all along that region. The city of Manbij today, which is under siege by the Kurdish and Arab militias against ISIS hold up in the center city. It's going to need immediate and massive reconstruction assistance. And I think it's doable, even before the war is over, even before anybody agrees on the ultimate political status of the Syrian Kurds. And I think a very good precedent for this, and I know Betty's going to talk, I think, about the Iraqi precedents for good and bad for this kind of effort. A very good precedent for this can be found in the case of the Iraqi Kurds, Iraqi Kurdistan. We protected that, in that case, about 20% of the country's total population, also in the north, for over two decades, even before Saddam was overthrown, even before there was any political agreement on the future of Iraq or the nature of the Iraqi government. We enabled them, we, the United States, enabled the Iraqi Kurds, 5 million of them, to set up an autonomous region that became relatively peaceful, prosperous, friendly, and protective of minorities of all kinds, Arabs, Yazidis, Shia, Christians, and so on. And something like that, I think, is quite conceivable and feasible for us to do for the Kurdish-dominated areas in the north of Syria. People argue about the merits of a no-fly zone or a safe zone or international intervention to protect minorities. Well, we can do it in Syria. This is something that actually worked in Iraq, and it can work in Syria. It's not going to solve the whole problem. It's actually going to make some people angry. I know that. Sunni Arabs are going to say, why are you only protecting the Kurds? And the answer to that is really simple. You've got to start somewhere. You got to do something now, or millions more people are going to be forced out of their homes and killed. So let's do it. And I want to say in conclusion that I'm not as sanguine about some other aspects of the situation as I think some of the other panelists, with all due respect, made it sound. For example, the Syrian army. The Syrian army is not intact anymore. It's already a minor player compared to the irregular militias and the foreign fighters that the Iranians and Hezbollah and the Shiite militias from all over the region, compared to the role that they are taking in the conflict today, compared to the Shabiha, compared to various freelancing warlords in different parts of Syria. The Syrian, it's too late to say, I'm sorry to say, that we should maintain the Syrian army intact. It doesn't exist. Secondly, I think that although in a better world it would be possible to try to work with the Russians and with the Iranians and with their allies in order to stabilize the situation and move on to reconstruction, I don't see the will on their part. It's not for want of trying. The U.S. government has been trying for years to convince Russia and Iran to agree to an effective compromise on the political future of Syria, with Assad, without Assad. We're willing to be very flexible on that. We've been trying for years to convince them to stop killing people and to allow humanitarian relief into areas of Syria that they control. And they refuse. This is not our problem. It's their problem. I don't think, honestly, that Russia or Iran, despite our best intentions, are willing to listen on this. They are out for a military victory. And that's why we can't wait. If we want to help the people of Syria, we can't wait for the situation to stabilize or for a political agreement to be reached. We need to act now. Thank you.
On that positive note, Betty, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you, General Cheney, and thanks to ASP for this invitation. This is a very important discussion. These issues are very important, and I'm very happy to be here to engage. Again, I'm with the Secretary's Office of Global Women's Issues, and I just want to put in a quick plug for the office and what we focus on. We mainly work on advancing gender equality within our foreign policy, and we focus on several main areas. One is addressing gender-based violence globally, and we have a strategy for implementing that. We focus on increasing women's participation politically, economically, and we also address empowering adolescent girls. The basis for our work in terms of integrating gender within stabilization efforts in Iraq is the United States National Action Plan on Women, Peace, and Security. This was released in 2011, and it's based on the UN Security Council Resolution 1325, which calls for women to be included, for their inclusion to be increased in peace building, in reconciliation efforts, and for there to be a focus on violence against children and women in conflict situations. So I mainly want to focus on the process in which we have begun to integrate gender issues in the Iraq stabilization efforts. So the counter-ISIL coalition had established a working group on stabilization, which basically is focusing on making areas that are liberated from ISIL control to be more stable, and whereby those who have been displaced can come back to those areas. So we set up an interagency working group within the State Department to support the work of the stabilization working group, which is part of the coalition. And we've been focusing on integrating gender through that work. The United Nations Development Program set up a funding facility for immediate stabilization, and they have programming that addresses the immediate stabilization needs of areas that have been liberated from ISIL control. So this could include, for example, building up public works, infrastructure, making sure that people have livelihoods when they come back to these areas, and also building capacity for local governments and addressing reconciliation. So we've been looking at gender as a cross-cutting issue within the overall stabilization efforts. And our initial step in doing this was to ensure that there was a subject matter expert who's familiar with gender considerations in these types of areas on a team, a U.S. government team that went out to Iraq to work with the Iraqi government and the UN to begin stabilization planning. So we did manage to get somebody who, with a background in these issues, to go on that team. We also worked on a checklist of issues that are important to focus on in the whole framework of stabilization. This includes, for example, what kind of training would be necessary for those people who have first contact with populations that are, for example, suffered from ISIL abuse. So people who are going into these areas had a background in what would be the assistance needs of women and children who have been subject to abuse under ISIL control. So we developed that checklist, And we also worked on ensuring that the coalition going further, going on, would be looking at gender issues. I'm sorry, I'm going to have to stop there, and I'll take questions later. Thank you.
All right, Betty, thank you. You've all raised great issues here, but I have one pressing question, and I think I'll ask each one of you, and I'll start with you, honey. When we talk about reconstruction and stabilization in Syria, we all talk about U.S. involvement, and you mentioned specifically how the U.S. pulled out of Iraq prematurely, and it's evolved to where it is today. But Americans aren't universally appreciated over there, I guess is one way for me to phrase that. So some would say that if we don't do it, nobody will do it. So it has to be a U.S.-led coalition. but I kind of sometimes wonder about that. We didn't cause the Syria problem. We did cause the Iraqi problem. So there's a difference here. There's not necessarily an analogy. So I'd be interested in your thoughts on that.
It's spelled to Syria. We didn't cause the Syrian, is correct. But it's spelled to Syria because ISIS was created mostly by the assistance of a lot of these Sunni generals who were under Saddam, and they were left out of the coalitions in Iraq, and they were left out of jobs and so forth. So they joined ISIS and helped ISIS to develop the way it is. And ISIS went into Syria. But
Are you saying that ISIS caused the Syria problem?
It is part of the problem because you have al-Nusra, you have Ahrar al-Sham, and you have ISIS. All these Muslim fundamentalists are in the opposition. The moderate Syrians are very weak. So, I'm looking at solutions in Syria, and I agree with you. We have to help the refugees very much, and we have to do something. It is and the lack of the Arab countries' involvement on humanitarian basis and taking more refugees is a catastrophic thing, in my judgment. But we have to do something while we are trying to find a solution. Finding solutions, you have to take action somehow. There is no action. The Russians have a free hand. The Syrian army has a free hand. We don't want ISIS to win also the war and come into Damascus and run. So we are in a no-win situation. I would see, my judgment is I don't want anybody to win totally. Until we have the big powers like the United, under the leadership of the United States, find a solution, a political solution somehow, when there is a little stalemate. But we do not ignore the refugees, we do not ignore the catastrophe that is. Everybody could go and say something about the Iraq war. There's no, there's totally different opinions. But we certainly, when we went in and then we left before stabilization, these are two decisions that were bad, in my judgment.
I wouldn't argue the point either. Dr. Pollack.
Well, I think you're both right. I agree with your point that it wasn't American action or inaction that caused the Syrian conflict. So it's not the blame or the responsibility, if you like, doesn't fall on the United States. I agree with Hani that it was a mistake both to go into Iraq and then in the first place, and then once we got in, to leave before things were adequately stabilized. But I would just say this. I am trying to look forward, not backward. And while the United States isn't to blame for or responsible for any of these problems, if they are a threat to us and to our friends in the region and beyond, and they are, right? Terrorism, refugees, instability, spreading, spilling over borders in the Middle East, this is a threat to us. And on top of that, we have a humanitarian and moral, I wouldn't say responsibility or obligation, but an opportunity, actually, to do the right thing. And from a humanitarian and moral standpoint, and for once, it's also in line with our strategic interests, and we don't have to invade and occupy a country in order to get the job done, the humanitarian and aspect of it, at least. And so for all of those reasons, I think regardless of whose fault it is, there is a clear reason, a practical reason and a moral reason for the United States to do more in this regard.
I wouldn't argue that point whatsoever. I think part of my point is, though, what number of Americans or U.S. forces do you put into Syria? What role do they play? How visible are they? Are they not resented? Period.
Okay. As far as the humanitarian effort is concerned, the answer is zero. This is not going to require any additional U.S. forces on the ground.
Interesting. Matthew, any comments from the public diplomacy side?
Well, beyond the public diplomacy side, I mean, you've got to assess what's needed in the country. And this is a key issue within public diplomacy, is deciding what is it that you want to accomplish to begin with, and then integrating foreign public opinion into establishing a proper policy that actually accomplishes that objective. When it comes to, you know, the U.S. role early on, I see it questionable whether or not we could have really had any effect. And, you know, we see multiple ways this could have gone. You can do nothing, which is essentially what we did. And you see the situation that we have right now, where you can do something like we did in Iraq and Afghanistan, and you can see what happened there. Or we can do a little bit of something, as we did in Libya, where we actively engaged in parts of the conflict, and the situation there is, you know, arguably just as bad. So there's a lot of let's do something without a real understanding of what the end game of that is. And without understanding where it is that we want to go, it's hard to orient your forces and your policy and your resources, not only of your own country and your allies, to reaching that objective. You know, we can provide humanitarian aid, and yes, that saves lives temporarily, but how long do you provide humanitarian aid for? You can provide a no-fly zone, but you can end up doing that for 20 years. The problem isn't solved. And so you have to orient your strategic thinking towards that problem, and until you've identified that, and the way that all the other actors look at the problem and what they want to accomplish, it's really hard to move forward with what I would call an effective policy.
That's optimistic. Betty, on the women and children perspective, when you look at what's gone on with the wars that have been over there, and all your predominantly younger males have either gone off to war or disappeared, and who's left? It's the women and children. And trying to take care of them, involve them, and protect them, and then get them play a part in the government, what should we be doing there?
Well, I just wanted to, I'm sorry for that interruption. I just wanted to say that, you know, in terms of Iraq, I think we have a little bit more of a positive story there with regard to involving women and in addressing the specific needs of women and girls, women and children, because of how we've been able to work through the coalition to get their kind of focus, get them to focus on these issues. So, for example, in the counter ISIL coalition and their working group on stabilization, they agree that gender should be a cross-cutting issue and should be a focus for the working group. And Canada has agreed to serve as the focal point in advancing these issues. So it's definitely now like on their agenda, and they are now looking at that. There's the UNDP funding facility for immediate stabilization, which has a programming to address the immediate needs of communities that have been liberated from ISIL. And that UNDP, that funding facility, is addressing the specific needs of women and children who are coming back to those areas. So, for example, they will have cash for work programs that specifically address the types of programs that women can be involved in. What kind of work can women do when they come back to those areas? And what are the specific needs of women and children who come back to those areas? We've also been trying to promote women's participation in actual planning for stabilization, so that you don't have, you know, Iraqi committees or, you know, on the local level, on the national level, that are just composed of men, because it's critical to include the perspectives of women when you're looking at planning for communities when displaced people come back. There are particular needs that women and girls are going to have that are specific and that need to be addressed. So we are trying to ensure that women are included in these planning committees. And I mean, this is a work in progress as well, because, for example, the UNDP in their programming to address stabilization in these liberated communities are finding that there's some programs that had not been as successful as they would have liked in, for example, the cash for work programming, because when women had come back and they had, you know, encouraged them to get, you know, involved in particular types of work, for some reasons or other, due to cultural reasons or whatever, they were not they would not do that kind of work. So we were getting less and less participants in those programs. So now they're looking at, for example, work outside. You know, women would be less likely to work in those types of jobs. So now they're trying to find work when women come back to these areas. And as you said, many of these families are women-headed households. So they've got to find some way to, you know, produce an income to support their families. They're looking for specific types of work that women will do and more liable to do. They're also looking at microcredit, microloans for women as well when they come back to these communities so that they can take care of their families. So there's a whole host of issues that need to be addressed to accommodate families coming back, particularly those that are headed by women, who have to support their families. So it's a work in progress, but, you know, we feel very good that this working group and the Counter-ISIL Coalition has recognized that gender is an important issue, it's a cross-cutting issue, and that there needs to be an ongoing focus on gender in its work.
Betty, great comments, and I'm pleased to hear that state's looking at it and that we're getting behind it.
My experience in this field is limited to Nablus, where 8 years ago, some young American women went down to Nablus. We had a center. We started this organization near the toughest refugee camp called Balata. These girls went into Balata, talked to women. The men did not want to send their kids. First they said, this is CIA, this is Israeli intelligence, this is this. My answer to some of the intellectuals of the city, whatever it is, take it if it is good for you because you don't have anything. But the women were the ones in the refugee camp who were powerful enough to overrule the men because they want their child to live. They don't want a child to go and at 10 years he wants to be a suicide bomber. They want a child to smile. Our experience became, in 8 years, we have interns from different colleges in America, from Harvard, Yale, whatever. We had 8 years, everybody stays in Nablus. We had not one incident of any violence against our staff from America. They go to refugee camps, they eat with them, they dine with them. The mothers started coming to the center because we started giving them exercise because they'll have 10 kids and they're weak, the husband comes and wants to his dinner, whatever it is. When they started learning English, they wanted to start computers, and this is how the programs picked up. It's amazing how the child, you start looking at the smile of the child. It's a story of a great American story of young American women who did it on their own. I didn't do it. I just gave facilities, but they are, and it shows that the experiment in a refugee camp works, in the toughest refugee camp, works, and they, our people were protected because they came to, in good terms to help kids and their mothers. And then we developed the business aspect and how. It's funny because in Najah University in Nablus had 20,000 students. The majority is women. But what they do after they get married and they don't work. So there is no, you're taking, I talk about that in Nablus. You're taking a place of another person who's going to work. So you got to work even if you're getting get married. So this is when we started the business issue for them. How to be a wife and work. And add value and add money to your income.
What a great template.
And if this happens in the whole Middle East, because the whole Middle East is a youth issue, uneducated, people have no jobs. And if we start from an early stage, and across, I tried to do it in Cairo, then something happened. I was in Cairo when the first events happened against Mubarak. I was with two of our directors in Nablus. And we had the center. If we do it in all across the Middle East, from the ground, and not through United Nations thing, because the overhead, for instance, our overhead are 15%. So if I have $100,000, $15,000 goes, and I know the UNDP, and I know the UNICEF, and I know all these things, it is people who are dedicated. Our salaries are very low. And everybody has to eat at the center and so forth. There's no cars. no SUVs, no nothing. You get in the bus with the people. And this is the amazing story of success, because 85% of our money is on the ground, 15% in overhead. I had this discussion with the UNDP guy. He used to be ambassador in Qatar. And we had about 2 months ago here, we had this discussion because they're having problems in money, whatever. But these are the issues we have to deal with the new Middle East. It is a catastrophe, the Middle East today. Is how you bring youth, how you bring women into the working force, into empowering them, and how you bring youth into education from an early stage of life. 501c, American organization that are transparent, you know, where no offices in Washington, for instance, offices on the, we have to set the tone to help organizations that have no offices and no big salaries in Washington. Those on the ground are, and this is the process we should follow.
Honey, great model.
Sorry about that.
No, I got it. We've got about 10 minutes to go, and I'd like to open up at least to get some Q&A going here. What we'll do is if you just raise your hand, I'll pick on you. We'll bring you a microphone. If you could just tell us who you are and your affiliation and hopefully have a brief question, and we'll go right from there. And this young man here towards the front.
My name is Daniel Sirwer. I'm a professor of conflict management. I direct conflict management at Johns Hopkins SAIS. And I'm delighted to hear all the positive sentiments on the panel. But I confess that experience suggests that things are going to be very difficult for each of you. Honey, I agree, civilization should come before reconstruction, but it's not going to happen. The Russians and the Iranians aren't going to permit it, and they've made that quite clear. David, you mentioned Idlib as a place to begin reconstruction. The Russians are destroying Idlib intentionally, purposefully, and targeting specifically things like the White Helmets headquarters that are intended to make life easier for civilians. So any reconstruction you can expect to be destroyed right away. David, also, the Kurds of Syria are quite different from the Kurds of Iraq in their relationship to the Kurds of Turkey. The relationship is a much closer one politically, tribally, and in other ways with the Syrian Kurds. And I have my doubts that you can pull off the same kind of thing in Iraq. Betty, what can I say? Jenaroff was on the news hour last night describing how pregnant women are coming out of Fallujah and have absolutely no shelter, absolutely no assistance, are lying in the desert. And Matthew, who are we? I mean, what makes, I hope my government never puts a dime down in Syria unless there's a political settlement that we can live with. I think it's very unlikely that there'll be one in which we're able to do the types of things that you suggest.
Hey, great comments. Let me give it to David to see what response you might have.
Idlib is, I agree, partly no longer as safe as it was a year or two ago because of Russian intervention. But there are still places in Idlib that are relatively safe outside of the big cities, the big city, and particularly places near the Turkish border. But if Idlib isn't safe, so Dara or Deir ez-Zor or some other, or Hasaka. I mean, There are places in Syria that are relatively safe right now. Big places, millions of people live there. And that's why we can do reconstruction and humanitarian relief there right now. And of course, if we were willing to adopt, with all the risks and costs involved, a more active policy, maybe we could convince the Russians to stop bombing hospitals in Idlib. On the Kurds, I disagree completely. I think that while it's true that the Syrian Kurdish dialect is Kurmanji, and it's true that there's a history of connection with the PKK, and it's true that there are many families that have relatives on both sides of the border, the fact remains that 4 years ago, the PYD promised Turkey that it would not fight against Turkey and it would not support the PKK against Turkey, and they have kept that promise meticulously. And even the Turks would acknowledge that, although politically they find it, Erdogan and his government find it impossible to say out loud that the PYD is not the same as the PKK. It's not. And in fact, it would greatly serve Turkey's interest in the longer run to create a relationship with the Syrian Kurds similar to the excellent relationship that it has with the Iraqi Kurds. The interests that they have in common are much more important than the dialect that they don't have in common.
Anyone else? Betty?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't disagree that the humanitarian needs and demands now in Iraq are enormous, and they have to be met. I mean, what's going on is, you know, is very worrisome. And but the, you know, I think the international community has to come together and address the humanitarian needs in Iraq, particularly among those displaced. When I talk about gender issues, I mean, it's more than ensuring that pregnant women have the medical attention that they need. We're talking about ensuring that that gender is taken into consideration when you're looking at stabilizing communities. So when you're dealing with women heads of households, you're going to have to see that these women can take care of their families. You're going to have to look at security concerns. You're going to have to, you know, address all the different variables that concern women in those areas, because, you know, we're not going to have, you know, real stable areas if we don't make sure that the needs of women are addressed and that women's perspectives aren't taken into consideration. So, I mean, they have to be part of the equation when we're looking at stabilizing communities in Iraq, and that when we were bringing back so many displaced people. So, you know, all I'm saying is that you have the humanitarian concerns and they have to be addressed. We're looking at, in terms of gender, we're looking at a very broad area of as part of the stabilization process.
Thank you. We had one.
Yeah.
Yes, ma'am.
My name is Bolar from the Embassy of Mongolia. In regards to furthering U.S. assistance in Syria, I know the Obama administration pledged to take like 250,000 refugees. Do you guys have any statistical facts that whether the refugees have started to arrive? And second question is whether women and children are brought into the U.S. So in regards to the U.S.-Syria.
I'll punt that to Betty first, and then I'll add a caveat to it.
Well, actually, I can't speak to the specific numbers, but I believe they're far lower than that. And, you know, there is quite a long process to refugees that come to this country. So I'm not in that office, so I really can't speak specifically to those numbers and the process. So I'll have to let that one go.
Yeah, I sit on the Foreign Affairs Policy Board and get briefed on it about once a quarter. And well, let me say up front that I think the number that we've agreed to take in is such a almost insignificant number. It's abhorrent. That's Cheney's opinion, and perhaps ASP's as well. And it's a drop in the bucket compared to the number of refugees that exist over there. We could easily take hundreds of thousands more, and we have in the past in other situations, but we're not doing it here. And the other part of that is, and Betty alluded to it, is this clearance process that literally takes years. So I think to really answer your question is no, we haven't seen any come in recently. And it's just taking so incredibly long to vet them and get them, although they're trying to speed it up. It's just not making a dent, in my opinion, to the overall situation. And given the political atmosphere in this country today, I'm not sure that's going to be changed anytime in the near future, although I dearly wish it would. So that's probably not the answer you're looking for, but I don't think we're helping much. I got chance one more. I see a gentleman back here. You were first up, so.
Good afternoon. My name is Eric Hummel. I've worked reconstruction in Iraq, and I was a provincial reconstruction team commander in Afghanistan. Currently, currently an independent consultant and trainer for stabilization processes, people going over to those regions. It's been said that that our biggest threat is not another peer-to-peer actor, but those nations who are unable or unwilling to take care of their people, basically failed states. So if that is truly the biggest threat to our national security, why don't we have a peace and stabilization function? We have the military, great at killing people and breaking their things. We have State Department, great at diplomacy, but we're missing something in between. Why is that?
Eric, thanks for your work overseas, for sure. Matthew, you want to take that one on?
It's a good idea, but difficult to implement. We've been using military troops essentially as peacekeepers, as war fighters, as any task that we want to assign them, partially because the military has a can-do attitude, and they do. If you give the military a mission, they're going to say, we can do that, as they should. But we also have to, as a nation, recognize the limits of what they can do and recognize the sacrifices that we ask them to make in truly difficult missions with possibly no end. So that being said, it is, in my opinion, useful to have an in-between force that is essentially not necessarily a peacekeeping force, but a peace-building force. Maybe that might include elements of security, that will certainly include elements of civil society, but I don't know of any nation that does this particularly well or understands how to do it, and we'd be talking about building something out of nothing. And in this time of fiscal budget constraints, our military wants to get back to straight war fighting. We want to get back to doing amphibious invasion training. We want to get back to air-to-air combat and that sort of thing. But that's not the reality we face in the world today. So, it might be appropriate to, in the future, considering the budgetary constraints, consider, how much of a standing military we need for military-to-military engagement versus what we need for dealing with the failed states that we have right now and understanding how to divide the role up between those two institutions.
Yeah, just anecdotal story. After OIF 1, I had a very good friend of mine who was a prominent banker on Wall Street, a West Point graduate, had gotten out of the Army, and the Army called him back to reinstitute the banking system in Iraq. Not exactly the military's job, but, and then I had another friend of mine who was a farmer out in Tennessee, and he was called back to work the agri. You'd have thought Department of Treasury, Department of Agriculture, Department of Commerce would all kind of cross-reference, and we'd have some kind of a joint interagency effort that would do that, and your point is well taken. We haven't learned, I don't think, as well as we should. With that, I want to thank our panel. This has been a unique experience for me. I hope for you all, too. Every one of you has just given us great insights to this issue. It's not a dead issue at all, and ASP wants to keep it alive and burning despite the political atmosphere over the next 6 months. We intend to follow it up with further panels, and I think it's important that we do that. I first want to thank all of you all for being here, and secondly, if you could thank our panelists.